This is history 12, and that means in the sequence of our education, we're going to let the phase of history now take its place in a form, and a new phase is going to emerge. The new phase is science. But characteristic of our education, in order to let each phase have its articulation, we're going to have an interval so that the lecture next week will not be a part of history, nor yet the beginning of science. It will be another interval lecture. These interval lectures have a double place. They establish an articulation between sections, each section being 3 months, 12 lectures. But the intervals themselves accumulate, and they constitute what would be a complementary form to the regular phases. In the two-year cycle that we have, there are 8 different phases, 4 in each of 2 years. It means that at the end of each of the 8, there are 8 interval lectures. So the interval lectures, if they were collected together — collected is not the right word — if they were constellated together, they would constitute an 8-part form, an interval form, which would be a complementarity to the 8 parts of the phases of our education. So that each interval lecture has as much weight as 12 lectures in the regular presentation of the education. This is because the receptivity, the acceptance, the absorption, the silence, the intervaling is much more powerful than the projecting, the emoting, the discussion, the giving of information, the giving of form. Powerful though it seems, much more powerful is the acceptance. A little acceptance goes a long ways. A little absorption goes a long ways. A little silence balances a lot of language. In music, when you're having some musical form that's particularly dynamic, the moment of a slight interval has a great power to it. There is a slight pause in Mahler's 4th symphony where the orchestra has just been giving you an oceanic, sentimental, symphonic cascade of tone, and there's a slight pause in the 4th movement, and you almost collapse. There are moments in musical development, like Vaughan Williams in his great 9th symphony, that has characteristically built into the dramatic structure a slight pause in the symphonic development so that the whole orchestra, instead of continuing, pauses for one beat. And those pauses establish this almost intolerable pathos of the situation. The modern mystical American composer Alan Hovhaness has worked pauses and hiatuses and intervals into his compositions in such a consummate way that sometimes one just simply learns to extend the acceptance of the mystery beyond the intervaling, beyond that moment of the pause, to extend that largesse of absorption to the music itself, and then one gets it. One realizes that sometimes the dramatic silences that are woven into the expressiveness, into the language, gives you the most intense of all artistic experiences, the most cogent statement of this, I think, ever written was in Dylan Thomas's Theory of Poetry, where he said, you have to leave spaces in a poem for the lightning and thunder to come through. This harkens back to the old Paleolithic wisdom of men and women. In those millennia, before we had any kind of toehold on controlling nature, on dealing with nature, even in a struggle way, when we were just simply at the mercy of the weather, of the events, the wisdom of Paleolithic men and women was not to always depend upon the strong, accurate throw of the great warrior who could throw a spear into the jugular area of the mammoth, but to learn that instead of looking for that fantastic throw that would bring the game down, to dig the pits and put the nets and trap the game, to snare the game, that you can eat a lot better in a more assured way by learning to make the snares to trap, to make the spaces which will fill. And so Paleolithic religion was always characterized by those strategic hiatuses that were woven into the intelligent life. The Navajo blanket always has one thread which is not a part of the composition of that blanket. It's the spirit trail. It is that thread that goes off the composition and allows for the gods to come in. It's that Paleolithic quality of intelligence that we need to employ with the intervals in the course. These are spaces for our articulation, but they are also opportunities of what is beyond us to come in, to participate. We have taken a number of intervals from the classics of world spiritual experience, and so interval 7 will continue that, and the volume that we're going to use for the interval will be the Dhammapada. The Dhamma is the Pali pronunciation of Dharma. Pali is a southern accent of Sanskrit. Dhamma is Dharma. Pada is path. It's the path of Dharma. It's the way of truth. Parmenides' great mystical pre-Socratic poem was called The Way of Truth. So the way of truth is an ancient, not a Paleolithic technique, nor does it come from the Neolithic eras, those millennia that replaced hunting and gathering with planting and with taming of animals. But the Dharma path, that way of truth, comes from symbolic civilizations. And about 500 BC, there was a great flourishing of wisdom texts everywhere in the world at that time. And the Dharmapada comes from that era. It comes from the time when one learned to constellate, one learned to accept the excerpts from the whole field of inquiry and let those collect together, let those constellate together to make a trap, to make a pit, to make snares, nets, where human, forceful, aggressive intelligence would fall in. And would find itself, instead of being the hunter, would find itself the game. And in this way, intelligent men and women learn to trap their intelligence and not let it carry them away with its own program. Because by the time of symbolic civilizations, men and women had learned that the mind very frequently does disservice to our lives. Not just because it has bad ideas, but there is even in the structure of ideation an abstraction, a process of abstraction that all by itself, if not watched, gets away with murder. And so what is natural to the mind, its abstracting, is really antithetical to life. And a little abstraction goes a long way. And that little abstraction has to be woven into a fabric of life, into a pattern of life. A little abstraction, like one thread in a whole composition, is plenty. One zero in the whole welter of numbers is plenty. Because abstraction has this kind of radioactive quality that it contaminates everything it touches with itself. One little instance of abstraction is more deadly than a gram of plutonium. It is more deadly than a grain of plutonium. Because the abstract moment is a place where time-space itself is brought to a complete negation. And the only momentum that time-space has after that nanosection, that picosecond of abstraction, the only momentum that is possible in space-time is when the dimension of consciousness comes into play. So powerful is our mind that it can bring the entire ceaseless change activity of the universe to a complete dead halt. The ancient name in India for that is moksha, which means extinction. It was likened in Jesuit times when they first were in India trying to understand what the Hindus were meaning by moksha. They got the idea from excommunication that the candle goes out, that every light in the mind is snuffed until there's just one candle and that's blown out. There's a beautiful presentation of that kind of a moment in David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia, where near the beginning Lawrence is talking and he's reading the newspaper about events that have happened during the day. And he's saying that the British Empire doesn't realize, but that there's a huge, momentous change happening in the Arab world. And he finally gets a chance to go and explore that. And he holds up a match, which he has used to light some very important tobacco, and he holds the match up and he blows it out. And David Lean has this moment of blank screen. And just very slowly, although it takes only just a few fractions of a second, you understand that the camera has shifted to the desert at the sunrise. And the slow red glow of the sunrise shows you that you have been returned to the mystery of the natural world. If consciousness does not understand self-consciously that we have been returned to the mystery of nature, the abstraction of the mind becomes a negative. It shorts out everything that will happen. So that always and every time one would have instruction in this profound, high energy, nuclear physics of the mind wisdom, the high Dharma, where you are trained in techniques that can short out the universe, that you can bring the ceaseless surge of all of nature to a dead halt. You must also at the same time have that spark of compassion not to continue to do this. To let life go on. To respect that others have life. And though they do not have the power that you have now, to bring the universe to a period and vanish that black dot. Nevertheless, they also have much more than you, the compassion to continue to live, to respect life, to live life. And so, along with moksha, one has to learn karuna, anahata chakra, vibration. We live in a time where these paths, these dharma paths, this Dhammapada is like a 20-lane highway. It is possible to take hundreds of millions of people at a time now and train them in techniques so that they could bring the universe to absolute zero. And this is fearful. It was fearful when one person could do it out of a million. It was fearful when one person in a millennium would be able to do that. And in order to deal with it, men and women in an ordinary sense would raise on a pedestal and enshrine in some kind of an iconography that this was a special individual. This is superhuman. This is a Buddha. This is a Christ. But when you have hundreds of millions of people on 20-lane wide Dharmapada that can do this in the future, this is very fearful. And so the response is as current as today's Los Angeles Times. Headlines: Russian bill deals blow to freedom of religions. Only state-supported traditional religions will be permitted in Russia. The isms are still there. It's not communism now, technically. It's Russianism. And it's not just in Russia. It's everywhere. Because on the opposite side of the front page is building a universe, a molecule at a time. Man's capacity to engineer matter, material, tailor-made to his specifications. Whatever you want, we'll make it for you. It's today's newspaper. Not only did Lenny Bruce used to use today's newspaper, and Mort Saul used to use today's newspaper for their acts in San Francisco and once upon a time, I think Mark Twain was the one that originated the phrase. It's as recent as today's newspaper. This kind of equality comes to a crunch in history. And whether history is seen as a process which one navigates, or that it is a thing which one has to deal with, gives you the polarity option that has now been consciously, philosophically placed before us for about 200 years. And the first voice to place that in this bare bones philosophic polarity was Hegel. Hegel, in his, towards the end of his, what became the end of his life, he died in Berlin of an illness, an epidemic. Of disease when he was just 60 years old, in the Berlin of 1831. And his lectures on the philosophy of world history is one of our pairs of texts, paired up with Burckhardt's Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy. We always take pairs of books, and when we come to the interval, we take one. So the last pair in history are Hegel and Burckhardt, And then we'll have the Dhammapada as an interval for 1 week only. What are they, Sean Connery and suspenseful film, The Hunt for Red October, towards the end, he says, give me one ping and one ping only. Because on level of high Dharma, one works with only unity or nothing at all. One irons the polarities down so it is a very clear, simple either or. It's all in one or nothing at all. Because that's the only polarity that you need for the final yoga. The binary language of Patanjali is summed up in a pair of words, shunyata and tathata. It either has void or it has suchness. The Greeks used to call that ousia, substance, from Aristotle. Aristotle lived in Greece about the time that the Dharmapada was being collected in India. They're very similar. Aristotle is all for trying to understand what it is in its oneness. But the Dhammapada is all about hoping to accept the understanding that it is nothing at all, ever. The one and the zero. Hegel, just before he died, he was the great professor at the University in Berlin by that time. His courses had the auditoriums packed. Students were hanging in the windows. And Kant was teaching down the hall, had maybe 3 or 4 students. Hegel says, in world history, the object of our inquiry is the idea as it expresses itself through the medium of the human will or of human freedom. And so right away, one has the complete dichotomy. Will, as an assertive determination that can be predetermined and is going to be. Freedom, as in who knows and one will never really know. Quickly, one of the geniuses of that age, Arthur Schopenhauer, developed this kind of a theme into a huge work. It's published in several volumes, The World as Will and Representation. That the world that is there because of the oneness of things, the being of things, which has everything to do with will and representation. You cannot represent the zero. You cannot represent shunyata, the void. The void, the moksha, does not represent. What does it do? It's not even an it. But what occurs every time that one allows that to trap you, the mind experiences that nothing whatsoever happens. Nada, shunyata, nothing happens, nothing whatsoever. Poignantly, exactly, precisely, nothing happens. That is to say, there is no ritual whatsoever. And ritual is the basis of representation. What happens then is that nothing presents itself. So instead of zero representing anything, it is pure presentation. And in its purity of presentation, it makes an infinite amplitude in which any presentation may happen. So that zero and infinity are logically linked together forever. Like Melville says in Moby Dick, meditation and water seem to be wedded forever. Anytime you start to get close to water, men start to look out and think. think about things. And Melville says, you take any day in the city of New York and you look at the end of any pier and all the people out there are meditating, looking out on the Atlantic Ocean. And that even within the context of the madness of New York City all around them. And as water and meditation are wedded together, zero and infinity in a pure presentational amplitude are wedded forever. But presentation has a whole different mode of occurring from representation. Representation, when it's good, is accurate. This represents one. It's accurate. So the accuracy is that the correlation of the representation is exact. And so when the world is developed in terms of will, its joy is in that exactness, that Aristotelian precision. It not just desires this, it needs this. The logical phrase in Western thought is necessary and sufficient. That the representation has this kind of accurate correlation is the pride, then, of the whole integral process. Integration depends upon this, and in fact, the very fulcrum of the program of integration is that identity holds. That the representation and the thing it represents have an identity. That one can count on this. Literally, the phrase is that one can count on this, one for one. Whereas in conscious time-space, in differentiation, its whole context is the zero-based amplitude that enjoys possibility and is a presentational mode, has nothing to do, is polarity to the representational mode. So integration always depends upon making identities hold. The whole certainty of an equation is that the identities hold. The most conspicuous mark in an equation is that equal sign. E equals mc squared. And you find book after book in physics talking about the E, talking about the M, talking about the C, and even the C squared. It's very rare to find anyone who notices poignantly that the equal sign is an equal distribution with energy, mass, light. That identity is a part of the quaternary of that particular equation. That energy, mass, and light have no integration whatsoever unless identity is factored into their representational action. This is a sobering thought. One gets very quickly that physics has to deal with the equal sign as much as it has to deal with energy, mass, and light. We live in a time where this awareness has become acute. It's not just that some people have gotten this, it's that this is scary time. And one of the most profound investigations of this, one would almost certainly have guessed, took place at the University of Chicago. In the 50s, I was an alumni of the University of Wisconsin, and we prided ourselves on being able to argue any night on any issue on any side. But at the University of Chicago, their pride was that they were going to be right and you were going to be wrong any time on any issue. So the University of Chicago is like this Fort Apache in the south side of Chicago. It's not only us against them, it's us. That's all there is. And there was a wonderful publication, University of Chicago Press, first published 1962 by Thomas S. Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And Kuhn, whose work had taken place in the 50s and then in 1962, out came The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And the whole notion that bowled everyone over was that of a paradigm. And what was so peculiar about Kuhn's paradigm, this is in chapter 10, Revolutions as Changes of Worldview. Examining the record of past research from the vantage of contemporary historiography. Notice that when it comes down, when it push comes to shove, science is founded upon historiography, the understanding and study of history. One doesn't do big science unless you can get sequence right. And not only sequence right, not only sequence in terms of representation right, but one has to be able to get the differential possibilities also clearly in view. Science not only deals with representation, it deals also equally with presentation. Science deals as much ambidextrously with zeros as it does with ones. So literally, the binary language by which science works is the binary language of zero and one. The very structure of a computer language is exactly the actual structure of the way in which conscious time-space happens and is discoverable by someone. But just as the three dimensions of space, when you add a fourth dimension of time to them, space changes. When it was just three dimensions of space, when it was three-dimensional, it had a block quality, a cubic quality. Almost exactly like the ancient Egyptians said in their religion. When Ra rises each day, he adds that day as a block to the unending string of blocks that last for millions of years. Ra adds each day to the infinite, boundless days that are possible and coming. So the Egyptian idea of eternity is that eternity builds by adding space with a time dimension one day at a time. The Egyptian title for their Book of the Dead is The Coming of Forth by Day. It's the temporal unit by which space is changed from a block to a curve. It took Einstein a long time to understand that when you add time as a dimension to space, space curves. And that the more that you have to factor in a time dimension in terms of an enormity of space, the more pronounced the curve. And that something so abstractly beautiful as the speed of light, as particles or waves, as light, as a photon stream, that when you go out over about a billion light years, you get curves. Light bends, diffracts off gravitational galactic focuses. But what we're facing at the beginning of the 21st century is even more devastatingly honest and insistent. And that is when you add consciousness as a fifth dimension to space-time, you get a completely different kind of a mathematic. You not only get that space curves, but you get that space-time becomes capable of a fractalization. And this is very profound. Takes your breath away. To have a mathematics of space-time is really difficult. When Einstein first came up with it, he didn't understand it himself. He used to ask a friend of his how to do the math. There was one time when I was a little boy, it was famous that only 10 men in the whole world could understand relativity in its mathematical formulation. It's nothing compared to a five-dimensional conscious space-time mathematics. Nothing whatsoever. That challenge is so enormous that it's almost unbelievable. And yet, that challenge is just the beginning of a fantastic curve. Because not only is consciousness a fifth dimension, but when spiritual persons constellate objectively as differential prisms of that whole dynamic, they make a sixth dimension. You have to take them into consideration. The observer is a part of what is observed. One has to understand that this is not only true, but it's necessary. Of course you count. You don't count when you're just a spear thrower on the plains a million years ago. But when you get a consciousness that's able to factor space-time itself, capable of zeroing out the universe, then the universe counts you. Then you're a part of the lists of essential ingredients of whatever happens. Then it's no longer that you live within the natural flow, but the natural flow has to consult you also, and so responsibility and compassion and wisdom have to be profound because you're now affecting everything that is. It isn't like social mores linked to the tribe. It's like you're talking about mathematics of the reality of what's going on. And so we face these kinds of challenges. But even more devastating is that the historical dimension becomes like a seventh dimension. Because as soon as history is a conscious space-time which has a personal dimension to it, is brought into its kind of a play, history occurs like some kind of nth power nature. It occurs with such titanic effect. It's almost like dealing with a unified theory of gravity and electromagnetism in terms of a conscious, personal domain that seeks more and more to have its objective not representation, but presentation. The universe is a representation of an integral cycle. But there is a numinous objectivity which occurs in presentational zero base amplitude. And that's called the cosmos. And the cosmos is not only conscious and personal, but it's historically alive. And this is a very big problem. Because once you pull the tail of that dragon, you wake it up. And it's not going to go back to sleep. And there isn't any place to hide. There are no caves so deep, so far, that you don't feel the heat. There's no place to go. Even on the far side of the moon, sitting in one of the largest impact craters in the solar system, one would feel the press of history, because the crater has a Russian name. So it's an excuse me time. Didn't mean to alarm you. But not only is the house on fire, the whole planet's on fire. And as the Buddha said, we don't have time to cast blame. We have to find a way to get out of the house. We have to find a way to get off the planet. Not that the planet is going to go, but if we stay here with the powers that we have evoked in ourselves and are now going, we'll incinerate the whole thing. The projection of World War III was a kindergarten projection compared to the apocalyptic reality that's right there. So I have to do something. What do we have to do? Have a new religion. Have a new world state. Genetically engineer the nanomolecules so people don't have that kind of capacity. Put little governors on people's psychic energy? I don't think so. Yet that kind of willful alternative is structurally built into the abstraction process automatically. If we don't consciously, personally, historically do something else, that will happen by default, just as sure as the sun rises. So the other side of will is human freedom. And freedom is something palpable. It isn't a good idea. It isn't a nice thing. It isn't something we want or we demand. It's a structural necessity for a personally conscious space-time to occur effectively in a historical dimension. It's as simple as that. It's as profound as that. We're going to take a break and we're going to come back. One last note here. Kuhn's structure of scientific revolutions within 7 years had to be revised. So many criticisms, especially about paradigm, which was completely ambiguous. Can you imagine the University of Chicago Press publishing an enormously powerful idea that was ambiguous? Well, they did. So they recollected many powerful essays by many people. This is volume 2 of Foundations of the Unity of Science, University of Chicago Press. Everybody is in here. The advisory committee included Niels Bohr, John Dewey, Bertrand Russell, a whole list. Everybody. Because it was a serious issue, because it got down for the first time to worldwide intellectual crisis. By 1969, when this postscript was written, there was like a ripple of attention across the planet. Thinking people, personally conscious, space-time beings involved in the history of idea scenario finally got it that Kuhn had touched a live nerve. And there was something about the structure of scientific revolutions and the paradigm fulcrum of it that suddenly sounded like the headlines on the newspaper. It sounded like that's exactly what was going on. Because exactly at the same time as this was out, the first human being stepped on the moon. You could watch the damn TV, and you could go down, if you were in Chicago, you could go to the bookstore at the University of Chicago, and you could buy this new. I won't read it to you. Let's take a break. Part of the difficulty of consciousness is that it works in a completely different way. One almost could use the term antithetical to nature. If one is precise, if you go into a real high dharma, Yogacara idealistic assessment of it, it's not that consciousness works in a polarity to nature. It's that consciousness unpolarizes abstraction. So in a glib way, one can say, well, nature works in this integral way and consciousness works in this differential way, but that's not really truth. That's approximation, that's table talk. The reason that consciousness changes its direction, as it were, and works a different way, as it were, is because it does not stay in abstraction. What does that mean in layman's terms? What would Buckaroo Banzai say? He would say, consciousness is different from the mind. The mind has to respect the brain. It doesn't have any choice. And the brain, being part of the body, the brain is definitely structured and functions on ritual comportment. If you just do certain actions, the brain actually sets up not little pathways of nerves, but the neuronal clouds tinge and tilt themselves exactly to facilitate that. And life needs that. Bodies need that. So that brains are ritual comportments, they're ritual objectivities, and minds are symbolic objectivities that cinch with that, that align with that. So you can talk about a mind-brain alignment, but consciousness does not align with brains. Consciousness could care less about brains. Consciousness in its own self is as interested in other people as it is in oneself. Consciousness is as interested in people long gone or people not yet born as it is with people who are here. In fact, consciousness takes a compassionate quality where one can be much more interested in someone else's mind than in your own mind. A brain surgeon really focuses on helping that patient's brain and doesn't think, well, you know, what advantage is this to my brain, or that I'm going to collect a big fee on this sort of thing. So that consciousness does not work against nature so much is that it reverses polarity vis-a-vis abstraction. Consciousness is vibrational, but not in a reductive, materialistic way. There was a psychologist named Boring, actually. Dr. Boring. Reminded of phrase from the American 50s. Salvador Dali was big in those days, and the phrase was Jesus on Christ on 12 crutches. It's too much for words. It's not that consciousness is some kind of promotional, vibrant target that sends out these good waves. It's not that at all. That target is already wrong when you introduce time into space. As soon as you put the dimension of time, space becomes curved. So the target is no longer a target, but sort of a saddle-shaped focus. And you add a couple of other dimensions to it, including consciousness. You have structures that are not possible to imagine, because the imagination only works in an integral way, and that sounds dumb. And we're told, the cultural chivalry of our particular time is that imagination is creative. It imagines things. Why else would Disney have Imagineering and pay, you know, millions of dollars to make hundreds of millions of dollars? Isn't imagination creative? The liminal boundaries of the creativity of imagination are those of perception. And yes, perception is not just a correspondence simplistically one for one. Perception always is creative, and imagination is creative to that extent, but it's always slanted towards integration. Images are representations. The image is a representation. But before the image can occur in a really objective way, there has to be some way for the object to interiorize into the mind so that the image occurs in the mind. Now, this can happen in a perceptual way. You can look at a bright light and then close your eyes, and you will see momentarily the rods and cones in your eye will continue to register the brightness of that volume. You can look somewhat indirectly towards bright sunlight and then close your eyes and they'll be like a green shape, the shape of whatever that sunlight was. And if you hold that for a while, the green will go to its opposite to a sort of a red and then will slowly fade from view. That's a perceptual registering, and the image that's there is an image which essentially in its structure is abstract. We think of an image that the image is the thing. Oh, the tree. We have an image of the tree. But it's the cut out geometricity of the shape which is primordial and which registers and which stays with us. And to fill in to that outline, one needs to have memory. And memory is a conscious differential mode quite distinct from imagination. Yes, you can imagine content for those shapes, but that imagination does not register quite in the mind. It registers in experience. It registers on the mythic level. It registers in feeling. So if you want to be clear about the content of images, you want to have really strong feelings. Images and feelings, or feelings raised to level of emotion. Give it to them loud and dirty, and they'll remember. Well, no, it's not that they remember, it's that their imaginations are captured by that. When Barry Bonds buried the Dodgers the other day with his home run, he crossed home plate, he stuck his finger up like that, he's making $7 million a year, he's got to do something. It's the image that we're number one, eh? The imagination has its play and has a certain amount of what we could call creativity, but the imagination is more like a craftsman, whereas the memory tends more and more to be like an artist. Somebody who is a great myth teller, not a mythographer, not like a Joseph Campbell, a mythographer, but a great myth teller who can tell myths, storytellers. they are distinctly different from, say, a Marcel Proust. The artist is totally different, is a differential, conscious space-time person, has dimensions in play, structurally a part of what is real there, that do not come into play on the mythic level, that do not come into play in perception, that even do not come into play in conception. Because the percept and the concept are bridged and linked by a language process, which is largely images that have been gestalted and held into ideational forms. Image always precedes the idea. And when you have an image base, that's the ground out of which an idea can gain its traction. So in the old inculcation education, if you want to get an idea across to someone, you illustrate it. You create an image base for them. You draw the pictures. That whole process is okay as long as you stay within the integral mode. But as soon as you have an education that is conscious, not to say even spiritual, you have to hold that at arm's length and let it be mitigated by a whole other series of orders of dimensionality that are natural then to truth. But in terms of natural, these new orders are supernatural. They're downright transcendent. They're certainly peculiar. They're mysterious. So that we have, when we look at human beings in times where their whole cultural reality, their whole mythic ritual symbol, integral mode of being, their cycle of truth and what's what, comes into a transformational node, into a time of crisis, into some kind of new age, some kind of suddenly a new conscious dimension added to the natural space-time. This presents a real difficulty, and we've seen it in terms of the history of our species now many, many, many times. The development of the understanding of history has proceeded a great deal in the last 200 years. Partly because of Hegel. Partly because he was so monumentally good at making language not define and represent powerful ideas so much as to take very powerful ideas and put them into visionary play through the prism of someone. And a lot of tough times have come out of this, because this is new, and we're not very good at it. One reader of Hegel was Karl Marx. And when you look at the problems that brought into play, from just that one example, one can see that this becomes very dicey very fast. But nevertheless, just because you can get your hands singed and burned by fire doesn't mean that there shall be no more fire in the world for man to use as a tool. And the ability to use conscious differentiation as a process in dealing with history is absolute necessity. Not a Hegelian absolute, but an absolute in the sense that there is no way in which that activity will not injure us if we don't deal with it. It's truly a planet on fire. The historical fires are deep and banked and going. And we can't turn away from it. Thomas Jefferson defined slavery one time. He said, it's like holding a wolf by the ears. It's absolutely wrong. But the issue cannot be ignored on the basis that, well, this is sins of the past, or this is a wrongness in the present, or this is a stupidity which eventually will be sifted out as human beings come along. This is an issue that cannot go away. You have the wolf by the ears. You have to deal with it. It's necessity on that level. Our historical crisis by 1997 is torrential. It's not only end of a century and end of a millennium, it's the turn of a 2,000-year cycle. What do they call that when you have three together in the stock market? The triple witching hour? Triple witching hour in terms of civilization. The worst choice is to do nothing. The worst choice of all the choices. There is no error that's worse than doing nothing. Even our worst mistake and botching it in the worst possible way would be better than no action. Because no action will result certainly in a devastation, absolute devastation. Not in terms of nuclear bombs going off, but in terms of minds not being able to hold form for a long, long time. You know what that means? Yeah. Already you can see the casualties on the streets of the world everywhere that you go. It's not that people can't think anymore. It's that they don't have the ability to form gestalts of memory and creativity and vision and personality at all. Because that entire range is something that comes in a transformation that furthers the development in nature. You're just not going to find prize mathematicians in the tribe. It's as simple as that. It's not that the tribe is wrong. That tribal level is extremely important because it's the mythic horizon. And it's absolutely essential to integration. There's no way that you can do without it. But it has a health. And its health is to give an image base, a feeling tone, so that thinking has a way to mature. Suzanne Langer, one of her great books on problems of art, wrote, she said, I am exploring the possibility that feeling precedes thinking, that thinking is an elaboration of feeling. And one must be intelligent in feeling before you can be intelligent in thought. You have to be smart in a feeling tone quality about life before you can think about it in any way that's at all accurate. So the mythic horizon is indispensable. But the mythic horizon, as indispensable, is a part of the integral cycle. And what's most difficult is that when the mind cowers from the challenges of consciousness, it retreats back, not on the basis of differential openness, it retreats back on the basis of abstract fear. And when you have a mind that's king of the integral cycle, functioning under fear of abstraction, then everything happens in a regression. And the first thing that gets regressed is the mythic horizon, the mythologies, the feelings, the experience. that gets stamped by powerful cookie cutters that the mind makes up called ideologies. And instead of mythologies, you have ideologies. That is a very serious problem. Our generations have lived through some of the worst nightmares possible because of ideological fevers. Since 1914, the planet has been racked with bouts of ideological fevers that have laid the patient right next to inescapable crippling. The casualties of the Third World War are planetary-wide. There are more casualties of the Third World War, which was never fought in terms of triggers, but was fought in the mind. And actually, the casualties are there already. Probably close to 2 or 3 billion casualties of the Third World War. We're trying to find some way to get through days that don't have any shape and never will have any shape until there is some kind of a blossoming of a personally conscious space-time that gives objectivity, that welcomes the mystery of nature, welcomes the actualities of existence, thrives on the healthy mythologies that go to make an image base for a maturation of thinking that can lead to transformations of vision and consciousness and art. And that population of men and women are well able to deal with history. It doesn't matter what problems there are, what the history is. We're made to function as solvers of situations. That's what we do. Our very species is Homo sapiens sapiens, wisdom, wisdom, man. We've been evolved over millions of years to do this. We do this really well. But if you don't know that you're feeding a regression, that there is an ideological imagination, like a cancer, literally eating up your mind and eating up the whole integral process without you even intending to or even knowing about it, and it isn't just you, but that it's population planet-wide. This is extremely disconcerting, and yet it's the situation. There was a time, much like our own generation, where men and women understood that being quiet and collecting your mind in a meditation, in a prayer, in a samadhi was a very good practice and necessary, even enjoyable. But there have been many more times in human history where these were forbidden activities. These were not only forbidden, they were heretical, punishable by death. Here's a little book that no one except few people will ever read, published by good old Oxford University Press, 1991, has such a hokey title, Working the Earth of the Heart. It's about the Massalian controversy in history. The Massalians, they were condemned by the Council of Ephesus in 431. People were literally burnt at the stake after this, because they insisted that a part of what was religious for them was spiritual quiet inside. And this is exactly the point that the Council of Ephesus said is heretical. Because if you have the right to be quiet inside, where is the church's authority going to be? And what you have to understand is that we goddamn well have the authority, and you're wrong, and you're forbidden. This actually happened. 1,500 years ago. It happened and it stuck. It stuck, mind you. It stuck for 1,000 years. What made part of the Renaissance in Italy was the rediscovery that it's not a heretical sin to be quiet inside, that there is such a thing as a focus, and that especially artists need to do that. They need to have that zero moment that doesn't X them out, that prepares them to view a creative space in a new way. And by 1431, you began to have people like a Donatello or people like a Brunelleschi wandering around, getting real quiet, and not going to Rome to do an obedience pilgrimage to some kind of hierarchical structure, but to go and measure all the buildings and spaces in Rome to find out how to build. Big Tom Masaccio and Brunelleschi and Donatello spent about 7 or 8 months in Rome. They didn't go to the churches to pray. They went to measure. Brunelleschi to make the big dome of the cathedral in Florence because no one was able to do it. And he found, yes, of course you can do it. Human beings used to know how to do these things. Look at the Pantheon in Rome. Agrippa built that 1,500 years before. That's a perfectly large dome. It'll be just right. One has to learn how to do this again. Renaissance, learning again what the wisdom used to be. Only in the last 500 years, we've discovered that the Renaissance keeps consciously vibrating and growing. It's not only a discovery that the Greeks were wise, but the Egyptians were very wise. The Chinese were very wise. The Indians were very wise on both sides of the globe. And not only that, there are all kinds of capacities that archaic man had that no one had ever paid attention to. That cavemen didn't carry clubs, but they did fantastic things long before there were civilizations around river systems that could be called China or Egypt. Or India. And we've discovered in our time now that our species, even a couple of million years ago, in forms that have long since died out, were deep in compassion. One of the books we're going to use in science is Mary Leakey, Discovering the Past. We're going to pair up with her Richard Feynman on QED, quantum electrodynamics. Mary Leakey, who found some footprints at Laetoli in East Africa. She found two sets of footprints, one large and one small, and they had been made about 1.8 million years ago in a volcanic upheaval, and the ash was coming down and covered the footprints in the clay with volcanic ash, and they were covered until 1.8 million years later when she found them. And being a tough, heartful, cigar-smoking, old British lady who knew her stuff, she saw that those footprints were remarkably clear, that some adult had held the hand of some child to walk with them through this raining volcanic ash 1.8 million years ago because the footsteps were coordinated. They were syncopated. Some mother cared about her child in the midst of volcanic turmoil almost 2 million years ago and never let go of that child's hand and ran on her own. That's what we're talking about. And they can goddamn well keep their ideologies. We don't need them. When it comes to talking tough, there was a time when the United States talked as tough as any people have ever talked. Renaissance Italy and Machiavelli aside, Tacitus and Rome aside, there was a time when Americans stood up toe to toe with the demons of historical fearfulness and said what they had to say. He's been dead a long time now. C. Wright Mills used to ride motorcycles around while he was teaching. He had this to say in 1957. This is a book, Power, Politics, and People. Mills became very famous in the 40s. He wrote the first monographs on white collar, that white collar workers could be sociologically categorized and talked about with the specificity of like an anthropological, sociological monograph. He followed it up with a work called The Power Elite, about the structure of such people and what they actually do and will always do, down to the bureaucratic T. You can still read Mills' works 50, 60 years later. Nothing has changed. He writes this: there is one last belief, this is 40 years ago, there is one last belief upon which liberal observers everywhere base their interpretations and rest their hopes. That is the idea of the public and the associated idea of public opinion. Conservative thinkers, since the French Revolution, have, of course, viewed with alarm, capital letters. Conservatives have viewed with alarm the rise of the public, which they have usually called the masses, or something to that effect. Quote, the phrase, the populace is sovereign, not that the king is sovereign, the populace is sovereign, wrote Gustave Le Bon, French sociological philosopher. And also the phrase that went with the populace is sovereign is the phrase, the tide of barbarism mounts. The two polarities. But surely, this is Mills, but surely those who have supposed the masses to be well on their way to triumph are mistaken. In our time, the influence of publics or of masses within political life is in fact decreasing. And such influence as on occasion they do have tends to an unknown but increasing degree to be guided by the means of mass communication. Any good demagogue knows this. There's a mural in Mexico done by Siqueiros. It's a huge mural. The whole building is devoted to it. It's called The March of Humanity in Latin America. He designed the building, he painted the mural, he did the sculptures that are part of it, and it was his way of raising a fist to the impossible and to indelibly put it there. And in the midst of one of the most profound mural images that is there, these steel cylinders of guns, I mean like battleship guns, are jutting out like some technological penises ready to just dominate. There's a bare-breasted woman just thrusting herself like some Aztec sacrifice goddess, refusing to be quietly shot. It's so overpowering to see this kind of quality. And art, with its spiritual consciousness intact in someone addressing a historical situation, can go toe-to-toe with it. But the difficulties are not the difficulties that you would suppose. They're not the mythic difficulties that you have dragons to fight, or bad guys to fight, or even bad queens to fight. It's not that those are the difficult images. It's your own regressive consciousness that is the formidable enemy. About the time that Mills was doing his work, David Reisman was doing some of his great work, another American voice. The Lonely Crowd, a study of the changing American character, came out in 1950. Reisman in The Lonely Crowd was the first to sociologically characterize the outer-directed and the inner-directed as different styles of being human. Only he noticed in his acknowledgments, in his preface, before he even got to the text, he said, there's something that I notice about my own country, my own generation, right now. He said, part two of my work suggests that for the more privileged classes in America, it is probably as important to feel free as to be free. Part three attempts to come to grips with the practical implications and limitations of that approach to life and politics. It begins with the essentially psychological and philosophical postulate that adjustment, no matter how comfortable it appears to be, is never freedom. Beyond adjustment to the prevailing mode of conformity, beyond obedience to or fascination by the peers, lies the possibility of autonomy. Autonomy arises when men use the opportunity presented by the loose fit of social character, which is never all of character. It's these kinds of qualities, these kinds of voices that were there half a century ago in this particular country, when the issues were really on the threshold, they have long since gone down the wrong way. Several generations have long since slid. And of course, the situation today is not nearly so much in view of crisis because everyone has tumbled down to the scree at the bottom of the cliff and aren't even up where the problem really is. And it's hard if you've ever tried to climb up scree to make any traction, any progress. But if you do manage to get back up to the cliff, you can see that that crisis, that threshold, never went away. That is still there. And part of the roots of it are a quality which Burckhardt, already 140 years ago, a century before David Reisman and C. Wright Mills, Burckhardt, who developed the whole idea of the Renaissance. There was no idea of the Renaissance, really, strongly, before Burckhardt. He's the one who brought that into play in order to deal with the historical situation that 140 years ago was devastating. He says here, besides Florence, there were many cities of Italy where individuals and social circles devoted all their energy to the support of humanism and the protection of the scholars who lived among them. The correspondence of that period is full of references to personal relations of this kind. The feeling of the instructed classes set strongly and almost exclusively in this direction. Then he turns to speak about humanism at the Italian courts. The natural alliance between the despot and the scholar, each relying solely on his personal talent. And then he goes into that whole thing. The co-opting of the personal by an opportunistic so-called individualism is like one of those snares that you don't ever see. You never see the problem. It's not a problem that is there in the integral form. It never presents itself as a bad guy. It's a condition that happens precisely because you never see it. It's not imaginable. You could not imagine that this could happen to you because it's not within the range of representation in the mind. There's no facility for it. You have to be able to juggle creative gestalts by a conscious memnonic differentiation to even be able to formulate the possibility that such a condition could happen. Do you think it's easy to build a universe a molecule at a time? You have to be able to envision structures that have never been real and yet can be brought into reality through the matching of a conscious form with the possibilities of hidden nature. Jacob Bronowski once said about alchemy, he said, it was not a matter of psychology. It was not a matter of intelligence, so much as it was getting used to using hands in a new way. The alchemists were always getting burnt and singed and poisoned and everything because it was a hands-on process. And then Bronowski, little tiny guy, about 5'4", smiles into the camera and he holds up a hand. He says, the hand is the cutting edge of the mind. You have to be smart with your hand first, because the mind is going to follow that kind of dexterity. Consciousness finally frees itself from that limitation, but if it's wise, it reestablishes a connection with the hand. It knows that you're never going to be able to deal with natural cycles unless you can bring your hands into play. And consciousness allies itself with the hands. Art allies itself with ritual in order to make sure that the mind is balanced, so that the mind doesn't have an either-or, so that the mind doesn't have to make this dreadful choice between the willfulness of ritual and the freedom of art. So that when you have this kind of a balance, the mind finally gets it that the hand and consciousness are both part of an equanimity. And the mind learns to discipline itself and not make these apocalyptic, knife-drawn crises. And it finally learns to function as a part of the whole and loses its taste for grandstanding. You can't fault it for grandstanding. It's the crown of integration. It's the achievement of the whole universe in terms of the natural ecology. And were there no consciousness in reality, it probably could be said that the abstract stillness of the mind was the greatest achievement of God. But the fact is, it's only dead even average. The greatest, most powerful achievement of yoga is the most average thing there is in a conscious cosmos, is absolutely an everyday, ordinary occurrence. Now, just because people have little tiny facility in this, they parade themselves as gurus over everybody else, doesn't mean that that's true. It could not even be cited as kosher, is a Jewish word everyone knows by now, when you take a wonderful little paragraph from a book which appeared exactly at the same time as C. Wright Mills was writing his little essay on the American and mass society, the structure of power in American society. Exactly at the same time, Eric Hoffer published The True Believer. Eric Hoffer, who knew all about the hands and the mind, he was a longshoreman in San Francisco, worked on the docks. When I interviewed him a couple of times, he had big, sort of clear-rimmed glasses, plaid shirt, huge, beefy, meaty hands. Would take his glasses off, he would look aside for a second, then he'd look right at you, and with these big, meaty workman's hands, would make these incredible philosophic points. I remember I was interviewing at the same time Paul Goodman, who was the great Columbia professor, was the famous sociologist, and who wore gray sweat pants and sweatshirt to fit in with the students, but was New York sharp. But he never had the amperage of intellectual veracity that Eric Hoffer had. Hoffer writes this: "The vigor of a mass movement stems from the propensity of its followers for united action and self-sacrifice. When we ascribe the success of a movement to its faith, doctrine, propaganda, leadership, ruthlessness, and so on, we are but referring to instruments of unification and to means used to inculcate a readiness for self-sacrifice. It is perhaps impossible to understand the nature of mass movements unless it is recognized that their chief preoccupation is to foster, perfect, and perpetuate a facility for united action and self-sacrifice. To know the processes by which such a facility is engendered is to grasp the inner logic of most of the characteristic attitudes and practices of an active mass movement. With few exceptions, any group or organization which tries, for one reason or another, to create and maintain compact unity and a constant readiness for self-sacrifice usually manifests the peculiarities, both noble and base, of mass movements. On the other hand, a mass movement is bound to lose much which distinguishes it from other types of organization when it relaxes its collective compactness and begins to countenance self-interest as a legitimate moment of activity." And he goes on to say, I know that we're out of time for the tapes, but we're learning here for us. "There is a fundamental difference between the appeal of a mass movement and the appeal of a practical organization. The practical organization offers opportunities for self-advancement, and its appeal is mainly to self-interest. On the other hand, a mass movement, particularly in its active revivalist phase, appeals not to those intent on bolstering and advancing a cherished self, but to those who crave to be rid of an unwanted self. A mass movement attracts and holds the following not because it can satisfy the desire for self-advancement, but because it can satisfy the passion for self-renunciation." So when you make it an ideological platform to be self-denying because you don't want to feed the ego, you've made a very subtle mass movement for a tyranny it's going to be very difficult to characterize. Its evil cannot be imagined. There's no image base for that whatsoever. But that snare is like wire cable. If you get caught in it, every struggle will just choke you more. We live in a time where the whole landscape is mined with just such stuff. That's why we need an education, to patiently bring ourselves into a mobility where we can utilize the freedom that is really there for us, and in some very patient way, undo these snares and walk away. More next week.